Hello again, folks. It's actually quite a daunting task to come at June from a dissident right perspective, because it seems like if you're in the business of putting ideas and content on the internet and you're on the right, or you're a nationalist or reactionary, it seems like everybody has to have their June take, their view on June. And it's because there's such a huge wealth of ideas and concepts in June, and I think that everybody can sort of draw what they want from it. So your analysis of June probably says more about you than June itself, because you can cherry pick. You're offered this wealth of interesting ideas and concepts from Frank Herbert, and in this I'm mainly going to be focusing on his book. There's also been TV shows, which I'd never really watched, I wasn't interested in. There's the David Lynch movie, which tends to divide opinion. I actually think that's okay. I used to think of it as being more of a dark Star Wars when I was growing up, than so, because I didn't really understand what June was, and that was my framing of it. I actually read June, the novel, about for the first time about 8 years ago, but then since that time, of course, it has been a subject of many of a discussion in dissident nationalist alt-right type circles. And it's not hard to see why when you drill down into it. I mean, if you are interested in aristocracy, it's there. If you're interested in religion and a religious rebirth, that's there. If you're interested in the idea of a all-powerful guild controlling things behind the scenes, then that's there as well. If you're interested in this sort of a Nietzschean Uberman concept, that's there. So is just a straightforward warrior spirit. So that it speaks to a lot, even though, I mean, it seems that Herbert was basing this on more ecological lines. But let's just have a look at the world itself, or the universe in this case, to frame it a little bit. So June is actually set tens of thousands of years in the future. And this, immediately, this is a bit of a strange thing, because, especially because of Star Trek, we're used to thinking of in terms of where fantasy, like Lord of the Rings, would be looking backwards at this medieval past. And that tends to be what people on the right take an interest in, for obvious reasons. Whereas science fiction, as I say, because of Star Trek, is considered usually to be a bit more liberal. Because it's a progressive future where technology and life and everything is just going to get better and better onwards and onwards. So you end up where you've got the Federation and Star Wars. Well, I mean, it's used to be just spreading liberalism. Now they're sort of spreading social justice throughout the galaxy. And June is interesting, because June is set after a cataclysmic war with AI and with machines, which was called the Butlerian Jihad. So the progressive era has come and gone. It's crashed and burned. And what's emerged from the wreckage is a society which has gone back to something like 17th century France or something. It's very hierarchical. You've got barons and dukes and emperors, and servants and plebs and proles, and what it means is that even the way they fight, because now artificial intelligence, computers, they've existed in this world, but they've been all but purged and banned and made illegal, because they almost wiped humanity out altogether. And so, despite the fact that June is set thousands of years, tens of thousands of years in the future, the society has reverted back to a more traditional form, which would be, as I say, like medieval Europe or 17th century France or something like that. I mention that because a prime element of June is the idea of this bloated, decadent empire. And so the story, it features the Atreides house, which is, they've got their own planet, and then they are going to take over stewardship of the planet called Arrakis, which is also called Dune, which is the only place in the universe where this really precious substance called spice can be mined. And they are more humanitarian, which isn't saying much in the Dune world, in the Dune universe, than the rest of the galaxy, than the Emperor. And then the antagonists are the Harkonnen family, which is led by this disgusting, bloated degenerate. And the Emperor and the Harkonnens basically line up to plot against the Atreides family. And they're all pretty much wiped out by that. And then behind the Emperor is the Space Guild, who are also in charge of faster-than-light travel across the galaxy. So this is a sort of plot outline. And then Paul and his mother, Paul Atreides, is the young boy, and he is actually the product of a long social engineering project, eugenics project, by the Bene Gesserit sisterhood. There's no feminism in Dune. There's a clear warrior priesthood called the Mentats, and then there's the Bene Gesserit sisterhood, who are like these witches who've been meddling and prophesying that a messiah will come, but they've got it slightly wrong. And so Paul and his mother go to the desert after being framed and all having their whole house wiped out. They escape, and then what they meet in the desert are the Fremen, who are the native inhabitants of Dune, and live, there's not supposed to be many of them, they're very secretive and they tend to live underground. And they obviously aren't very happy about their planet being pillaged by all of these different houses, but then also the Space Guild, which is a sort of Rothschild's bank, pulling all of the strings behind the scenes. As I say, there's really a lot to get into. Yeah, Frank Herbert's definitely stumbled into some interesting territory, because it's the Space Guild who also understand what the Bene Gesserit sisterhood have been up to, and they demand that Paul in particular is assassinated, because, well, it's going to lead to big trouble ahead. And so Paul then has this kind of spiritual rebirth, and he begins to take on the mantle of this new messiah who will lead the Fremen to freedom and free their planet. And he discovers that despite the fact that no drop of rainbow water ever actually falls on Dune, well, what he discovers is that the Fremen have got thousands of caches of these huge underwater sumps, these huge lakes, which are just teeming with water. But the unfortunate thing is that back up on the surface, you've got these gigantic sandworms, which are there, they protect the spice. The sandworms are actually the symbol of Dune. If people think of Dune, or if they see artwork by Dune, they usually think of the sandworms in the same way that it might be the Death Star from Star Wars, or Gandalf from Lord of the Rings, something that is instantly recognisable as being a symbol of that particular universe would be the sandworms. And the sandworms have this symbiotic relationship, and it's when Paul begins to understand the connection between the spice and the worms and Dune, the Arrakis, that all of this starts to come into shape, and then he begins to find his destiny. And so, yeah, what's interesting about this is that you do have this, on the one hand, you've got this empire in league with these backstabbing houses, and all of them are in league with the Space Guild, who are, you know, seemingly all powerful. They're also mutated, and they need the spice in order to carry on their nefarious plans of their own and have a stranglehold on deep space travel. And all of that, all of these forces and the elite troops in the world, the Sodicon, they're all lined up against this native population on this remote planet. Everything is thrown at them. And so it's very interesting to me that what Paul has to do is lead what amounts to a jihad, which is literally called a jihad, against these overwhelming forces and a kind of spiritual rebirth. I will say, when I first read the book, I found there were so many Arabic and Islamic themes and names in this that I was going through the counter jihad phase, and I found it quite off-putting, to be honest. But it's really a stand-in for a spiritualism which is against the prevailing order, against the dominant power in the world. And of course, there's the obvious allegory where the spice is just a stand-in for oil. And so what you see with the empire and this, the, you know, the space guild mutants behind the scenes is where they've gone out to the desert and they're plundering of this precious resource. And so then you have the native inhabitants standing up to it. Again, 8 years ago, I wouldn't have been very comfortable with that or having sympathy with that. But I certainly do now more so. I would more so take the side of the downtrodden people than the overarching empire. Essentially, you can see that it's, even though the book was written in 1965, there's definitely something to be read in there along neocon policy in the Middle East. But in wider terms, we can then look at it, broaden it out, and then look at it at how people on the right look at the world in Europe and in North America. And it's pretty much the same story. It is where you feel like you're being suffocated with this overbearing ideology and with all this corruption and all these very decadent degenerates in positions of power, and then they too have this the woke money power behind them every step of the way. And so this is what, as I said, I think what you take from June, it depends on kind of your own ideological leanings. My friend the Distributist did a great video on June where he mentioned more from a Catholic perspective. I can understand somebody else looking at it from the perspective of a Nietzsche and the arrival of the Overman. But what actually happens, what I think is interesting, is that Herbert seems to have this deeply pessimistic outlook. And so we begin where humans have machines and high technology, and we can think of it being the age of progressivism. And then you get the rise of this decadent empire, which and corruption in the empire. And then that's all going to be swept away by this small native people and this spiritual rebirth, this complete philosophical revolution against the prevailing order, which is something that a lot of people on the right secretly dream of, let's be honest about it. But and what form that takes is one of a lot of discussion and a lot of disagreement and a lot of arguments. But Herbert's got a bit of pulled a fast one, because it doesn't work out that way in the end. It ends up in a bloodbath. It ends up where the Fremen are, they're native to June, and they wear these special suits to keep themselves hydrated all of the time. But in the end, what they're doing, their big plan, is to completely change who and what they are. Because if all of a sudden rain begins to fall on June, then the sandworms are going to die and the spice will be destroyed. And so the planet will become this lush utopia. And this is a problem, because they are a race of warriors. They are like an elite band of jihadists, or however you would want to frame that, against the prevailing order. And yet, if their dreams came true, June would turn into this soft planet with lots of sunshine and lots of water, where everybody would be comfortable. For me, it raises an interesting question, because if you've defined yourself by revolutionary struggle, then you're victorious, do you then just settle and live a happy life? Because that doesn't actually happen in June. What they do is tear across the whole universe on this holy war, enslaving and killing everybody they can find. This is why in the... If I was to write, just to switch universes for a second, if I was to write the story to the Star Wars, those rubbish Star Wars sequels that everybody complains about, which have just finished, my story arc of that would be set it after Return of the Jedi, and then have where they're so paranoid. They've won at the end of the Return of the Jedi, but then I would have Jedi Knights carrying out purges and witch hunts all over the place, looking for anybody who's connected with the dark side. Because when it seems to be the case that whenever a revolutionary struggle is actually achieved, it doesn't just draw itself to a close. It doesn't just stop. This was the case with the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Iranian Revolution, and it's also the case with the Cultural Revolution in the West. There's always another thought criminal to be hunted down. There's always a secret capitalist hoarding cash, or somebody who isn't devout enough in the new faith. There's always a new enemy to be purged and destroyed. And so Herbert's look on this is kind of pessimistic. But I have to say, in terms of what's happening in the West, and you have if we liken ourselves to the Fremen for a second, and put ourselves in that situation, I'm at this point not particularly worried about that. I'd just happily retire and let it take its course, because it's been so brutal. Of course, the people, the elites, our emperors and our space guilds, they understand that as well, because they've studied this stuff for a long, long time. The revolution doesn't end, it just goes on and on. It just depends on the power dynamic. So Herbert's view of humanity is quite pessimistic, actually. And he doesn't offer a happy ending, which is so often the case in these kinds of reactionary worlds. Imagine how June must have seemed in America in 1965. Everything was progressing, technology was booming. There was a new, more progressive mindset among the young. The Cold War was in full swing, but even that had become a competition about resources and technology. The question was, which ideology would win out? Either way, humanity was on the path to one technological utopia or another. Star Trek reflected that, as did the liberal humanism of Isaac Asimov's science fiction. The past was a place of superstitions and primitive technology. The future would be a place of high technology, rationalism, and equality. The path of history went on in only one direction, and it was always progressive. Dune turns that on its head. The future belongs to scheming courts and emperors, to prophets who kill their enemies with a knife, to prophecies and religious awakenings and holy wars. The age of AI and robots nearly wiped humanity out, but eventually gave way to the age of aristocrats, which then, in turn, gave birth to a new spiritualism and religious fanaticism. And here I think you can see the appeal that Dune has to so many people on the dissident right, nationalist, traditionalist circles. It isn't just that tradition is reasserting itself, but a primal form of meaning and identity. And in Frank Herbert's Dune, you get it, warts and all. I'll catch you later, folks. Thanks for listening.